Judy Rebick supports Rabble because
Rabble's one of the very few spaces anywhere that you get a variety of views. All the new movements that emerged in Canada, whether it was Idle No More, the Maple Spring, the first place they appear is on Rabble.
Thanks, Judy. Just a few reasons to support Rabble.ca. Go to www.rabble.ca/donate.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
Rabble.ca. Hi, and welcome to Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note, a production of Rabble.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner, the executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. Today's show is an interview with author Lawrence Hill. It was done at Octopus Books last November. He talks to Ottawa author and journalist Wabgeeshik Rice about his novel, The Illegal. It's the story of a man named Keita Ali. Keita is on the run, in more ways than one. His dream was to bring his family out of poverty by becoming a world-class athlete, a runner. He does achieve part of his dream, but he also ends up being on the run after he winds up in a country with a zeal for deporting refugees. He and his family end up running for their lives. Lawrence Hill describes his book as being a meditation on being stateless in a world that doesn't want you. If you'd like your own copy of The Illegal, it's one of our thank you gifts during our Rabble.ca fall fundraising campaign. For a contribution of $15 a month or more, you can get your own copy. More details at the end of the show and in the show notes. First, let's get to the interview. From Octopus Books in Ottawa, here is Wab Rice interviewing author Lawrence Hill.
Clearly, this is a very compelling, very timely, very rich book. It covers a vast amount of times, vast geography. It involves some very rich, rich network of complex characters. So what went into creating this book? What inspired you?
Well, there are two sort of moments that planted the seed of the novel in me long before I knew I'd write it. One was in 1973, I was 16 years old, and I had my first summer job, and I was working at Toronto Airport. It wasn't yet called Pearson. And I worked for this group called the Ontario Welcome House, which was an agency of the Ontario government. And my full-time job for the summer as a 16-year-old boy from the suburbs of Don Mills was to greet immigrants who were arriving at Pearson for the first day in Canada. And I would go meet them off the plane and help them find their luggage and help them get up the escalators without breaking their necks. Many of them had never seen an escalator before. Many didn't have accommodations, so I'd book cheap housing for them to get them in a cab, get them to a place that was cheap for a few weeks till they could figure out where they were going to go next. I'd send them to what were then called Canada Manpower Centers and also tell them how to apply for OHIP. And so I was their first contact in Canada. So my job was to show some kindness, but also to give them some very practical help and advice, including helping them find a place to stay that first night, because many immigrants arrived with no place to stay. And they were at Pearson Airport. So that was 73, and it was a really big year to be working at Pearson, and hugely influential for me, because 73 was, well, 1 year after 72. And 72, as you know, was a year that Idi Amin expelled thousands of Ugandan Asians simply because they were Asian and because they were in the business class of Uganda. And many came to Canada. We welcomed them. But they didn't all come immediately. Some came by circuitous routes, and some of them took a year or more to get here. So that summer, every day I saw Ugandan Asians coming through Pearson Airport. I wasn't working with them. I was working with landed immigrants, but still I saw them. And for a kid from the suburbs, it was quite a sight. Mm-hmm. To see refugees pouring into Pearson Airport every day and waiting and waiting and waiting to be processed. But they were processed. And it got me thinking about migration and just what it meant. And then about 10 years later, I was I was parliamentary bureau chief for the Winnipeg Free Press here in Ottawa, covering Parliament and the Supreme Court. Parliamentary bureau chief sounds like a big deal. It wasn't. I was chief of myself. There's one person in the bureau, me. So it wasn't such a highfalutin job after all, but I was, on paper, parliamentary bureau chief of the Winnipeg Free Press and covering Parliament and the Supreme Court. And I started going to visit my sister that year that I came to Ottawa. It was a year that Mulroney won his first majority government. And I started visiting Karen, who lived in Berlin for a decade. It's my late sister. And she was trying to find her black roots. And just like I'd fled and gone traveling in West Africa to sort of find myself racially, Karen went to Berlin and started integrating with the black community in Berlin at the time to find herself. And as it so happened, most of the black people that she came to know in Berlin and that I came to know through my sister were Sudanese refugees who'd fled violence in Sudan, who'd come to East Berlin, who were let through the wall. You know, if you're Eastern European and try to get through the wall, you'd be shot. But if you're East African, go on through. Like, let's move you on through to the next place. And so they're allowed, unbelievably, to pass through the Berlin Wall, but they'd end up in West Berlin with no formal documentation. So they're sort of stateless, in a state of limbo, getting a place to rent, having the right to work, having a driver's license or a bank account, almost impossibility. So watching these people struggle and try to make a living and get pocket money when they weren't there legally was fascinating, and it planted in me the seed of this novel. So it just grew, and over the years, I became interested in refugee issues, and so it has been growing really in me since those two experiences in the 70s and 80s, but I worked on it actively, you know, just in the last 5 years.
Okay. With that in mind, obviously, this has touched your life for decades, and over the course of the history of humankind, people have been forced from their homelands, and there's probably no corner of the globe that hasn't been touched by the issue of refugees. So with that in mind, why create fictional places like Zantoro Land and Freedom State as the setting for this book?
Well, that's a good question. And first of all, some of our most compelling fiction is set in imaginary places. The Handmaid's Tale, 1984, Harry Potter, The Wizard of Oz, you know, Alice in Wonderland. I could go on, but invented places can be very liberating for a reader. And every one of my 9 previous books deals with a very specific place or set of places in a very specific socio-political historical reality. But first I was looking to break free of the constraints, the historical constraints of the Book of Negroes, and write something totally different. I wanted to break free as an artist and move in a new direction artistically. I needed that as an artist. But second of all, the story that I was imagining was about a country gone amok with xenophobia, a country that is sort of like the Front National getting elected in a place like Canada. Well, we haven't seen that, and hopefully we won't, although it could happen, and we haven't seen it. And so I didn't want the reader holding a measuring stick to every paragraph and saying, this isn't right, this isn't Canada. We don't have a country or a government like this. So how can he say these things? I didn't want that. I wanted to create two worlds that were made up, that weren't constrained by the specific realities of Canada or Australia or Texas or Arizona, but that just encompassed the idea of a world gone wild with hatred toward refugees. And so I felt the need for the first time in my life as an artist to invent two countries so that I could express the conditions that existed in my head, even though they don't reflect the conditions of a real country in the real world now.
I wondered, as you bring that up, the family party that runs Freedom State, was that inspired by any particular political party on this side of the world?
Well, you know, it's funny because I was asked by one of your colleagues on CBC if the Graham Wellington, the president, the prime minister of Freedom State, was meant to be Stephen Harper, and I said no, that's really unfair. I mean, this guy is, you know, Graham Wellington is a thug, and he's a criminal, and he's doing things that are heinously violent. And so it's unfair to make that likening. And so I said, no, absolutely not. I was thinking about a country like Canada slipping into the paralysis of xenophobia and losing its grounding morally, but I wasn't writing specifically about a specific leader. I did have in mind the far right in Europe, and as you know, if you've traveled in Europe, whether you're in Norway or the Netherlands or France, the far right is not shy about expressing xenophobic hatred to refugees, and you see it all over Europe now, and people aren't even ashamed to express feelings of great hatred toward people of other religious or racial backgrounds who may not be citizens of those countries. And these movements are on the rise. I hope they don't succeed, but they're certainly garnering popular votes. You know, in the last presidential election in France, where I was on book tour at the time of the election. Le Front National garnered 17% of the popular vote in the first round of the presidential elections. That's a lot of people voting for a party that basically has a hard-line opposition to the presence of refugees and undocumented immigrants and like. So I was thinking about the whole world. I was thinking a bit about South Africa in the townships where I've spent some time, because the place that Keita comes to hide, it's much like the townships that we see and that I've spent time in South Africa. You know, how is it that on one hand, a city like Cape Town is one of the richest cities per capita in the world, but it has, you know, one of the hugest townships of people who have nothing compared to, say, Canadians. Like, I'm thinking of Khayelitsha Township, which you pass driving from Cape Town Airport into Cape Town, kilometers and kilometers and kilometers. The community is so poor that the highway bisects. It's like the 401, the highway bisects the community, and kids are walking across a highway that where cars are driving 130 kilometers an hour. Mm-hmm. And so it's. I was thinking about all sorts of parts of the world, but I wasn't writing specifically about one of them.
Okay. And I'm sure this will come up when the audience has a chance to ask questions, but real life, real world experiences and situations, there's clearly a crisis of refugees coming out of Syria and Iraq now. And we saw over the past couple of months, many of them trying to flee into Greece on boats and rafts, and many, many tragically dying. This comes up in your book. People from Santoro Land try to get to Freedom State on
fishing
boats.
Yes.
Yeah. As your book was about to come out and you were seeing this in the news, what was that like?
Well, mostly, I was aware, of course, that although we're paying close attention now to Syria, hugely significant upheavals involving refugees have been going on since the end of the Second World War. And there are huge crises erupting all over the world while I was writing, before we were paying close attention to the refugees of Syria. And so it was just sort of sad to see the problem getting even worse, and to see millions of people I think the last figure I saw was 10 to 12 million refugees from Syria. 10 to 12 million, that's a third of Canada's population on the run, many in Syria still, and many others on the run elsewhere. So it was just sad to behold the crisis being so great that people are willing to risk their lives knowing there's a good chance they may die, and still they're risking their lives trying to jump on trains, you know, across the English Channel, or to get across the Mediterranean, you know, in a boat that's likely to tip, and it will tip, you know, many of them. So it was just sad and horrifying to sort of behold the magnitude of the nightmare.
Was it difficult knowing your book was about to come out, dealing with some of these specific sort of experiences?
Well, the only difficulty was that, I mean, I care about political issues. Like, I'm not a political animal in a big P sort of way, but I'm interested in politics in a small P way, especially social issues, political issues, issues of migrants. And so I care very much about these things. And I've been reading about refugee issues for years, although I'm no expert. I'm just a citizen who likes to read the papers and magazines and stay aware of what's going on in the world. But I felt that for the first time in my life as a novelist, I was thrust into a political role, because every time I spoke or was on the radio or TV, I was asked my opinions, you know, about federal issues relating to refugee politics, and I would state them. So just going on tour and talking forced me into a political role, even though not political as in vote for this party, but political as in this is what I think any party should be doing to deal with this crisis. These are my values, and this is what I'd like to see our country doing, regardless of who's at the helm of the country. And so I was forced to sort of step in much more than I usually have. So it kind of drove me to a more overtly political place, just because I kept being asked questions and didn't feel it would be, you know, courageous to run from them, so I had to answer them and state my values and sort of let that fall as it would. So I was sort of forced into a more political space, even though novelists aren't usually required to do that.
Well, one thing I really appreciated about the book was that the humanity in it really transcended any of the politics or any of the other nonsense that you know was batted around at the political level. And I think at the core of that was Keita Ali, that this character who's a very good, a very kind, a very pragmatic, very admirable person who, you know, he becomes humbled as he becomes older, but at his core, he really wants to do good for his family and his people. Where did the character of Keita come from?
Do you mean Keita or do you mean his father, Yo-Yo?
Well, I mean... Keita.
Well, he came from... Well, actually, his father, Yo-Yo, was a character in two earlier novels of mine, a minor character in Some Great Thing, my first book, and in Indian Own Blood, which was my second novel. Where Keita came from was, in a way, a similar place from where Aminata came from in the Book of Negroes. I wanted to write about a faceless person whose humanity would normally be totally overlooked. And I think that, you know, one of the casualties of the slave trade is that we collectively couldn't somehow see the humanity of people caught up in the slave trade, that they had lovers and that they had skills and that some of them had literacy and that they knew how to catch babies, be midwives, that they knew all sorts of things, applied those skills, and that their own self-identity was much more complex than I am a slave and I'm a faceless person in chains. And so I was trying to sort of create that humanity so a person could see beyond the mask of slavery and understand what a human being caught up in the slave trade might live like. And in this novel, well, I suppose if your chief objective as a citizen is to learn facts, say, about the refugee crisis, and naturally go to, you know, reputable journalism sources or read a report from the United Nations or read a report by some specialized person who knows a lot about it. But if your goal is more to understand a person's humanity and imagine more fully what they might be going through, to empathize more deeply with their plight, then perhaps the novelist is your best friend, rather than the journalist. We work together, of course, but so I guess where Keita came from was a desire to create a character that would give a reader pause, and give a reader pause to imagine the humanity of a person, one of the 12 million who's on the, or let's say 5 million out of Syria, you know, on the run right now, trying to find a safe place to live and get on with their lives without being killed or shot up. And so I was trying to evoke a greater empathy on the part of readers and to provoke their imagination about just what a refugee's life might actually look like and what some of the stresses might be.
Keita, he leaves his homeland of Zantoro Land, where he's facing death, comes to Freedom State, where he faces racism, yet at the same time, he becomes a fan of country music. He reconciles that, right? Which I love that detail.
It's funny, that bit, you know, country music. I think I'm not a huge fan of country music, but I was thinking, like, what would a person in this situation love and find comforting in the way of music? And just to pick up that on that thread for a second, Wob, like, country music has a clarity of expression. You can hear the exact words a person's singing, and it always has a story. Country music has a clear story, and it generally has an accessible melody. And I was thinking, this is what a person in Keita's situation might really long for: the clarity of voice, a story in the lyrics, you know, a melodic quality that's somehow comforting and easily accessible. And so even though I'm not a fan of it, I thought this is the music that my character is going to love.
Yeah, well, you're preaching to the choir, because country music is huge on the res mostly. So yeah, it's huge. I have to ask you this on a personal level, because I know your background as a journalist, and my day job is as a journalist. Journalism plays a huge role in this book. Yo-Yo Ali is a prominent journalist, and then Viola, the character who comes in later, without giving too much away, she's tenacious, and she uncovers some deep scandals within the system between the two countries.
She sure is tenacious, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I imagine that would be fun to write about. What was that like for you?
Journalist is a great character. Journalists make great characters. For one thing, they provide a novelist with a pretty easy solution to how to get a person from A to B to C to D. Journalists have to be everywhere. They have to be on the move. So a journalist is a great device for a character who needs to be moving through place and place and place. So there's a 15-year-old boy who's making a documentary film, who's a little kind of like a boy genius, who's making his mark as a journalist as a 15-year-old. He's kind of like a wunderkind. And then there's Viola Hill, who's trying to prove her stuff as a journalist and climb from the bottom of the pool of journalists in her newspaper, get out of the sports pages where she feels she's been stuck in the job ghetto, and make it in the world of news reporting. And she wants out off those sports pages, and she's driven in every way imaginable. And so she's on the make, not in a pejorative way. She's hustling to make a mark in a world that doesn't want her, you know, to rise. And so a journalist it can be a great character, mm-hmm. especially if you've got a complex plot where at least somebody's got to be everywhere. Mm-hmm.
The characters in the book are predominantly black and white. You come from a mixed background. I do as well. Do you see that as an aid in your storytelling, or do you feel like you're able to adequately tap into both cultures or both races, I guess?
I think so. It's funny, you know, like nobody ever says to Alice Munro, and you're not saying this, but I'm speaking generally now. Mm-hmm. Nobody ever says to Alice Munro or Jane Urquhart, well, I notice you just write about white people. You know, like, they're writing the worlds that they know, and as they should. And hopefully, Alice Munro or Jane Urquhart or anybody else is writing a book that will resonate with readers around the world and every class and background of people imaginable in the specific worlds they create, should somehow, they hope, I'm sure, have a universal appeal. And so I seem to keep coming back to black characters, which reflects my own background, and also to mixed race characters also reflects my background. But I have to hope and believe that if I write about things that I find intriguing and fascinating, that there will be a universality to them, and they're no less possibly expansive and interesting than any other person who's writing about people of other backgrounds. But it's a world I know, and I've often moved between the two worlds and often had a foot in both of them, certainly growing up. And so I feel fortunate, you know, to be able to move fictionally as well as personally, you know, in both communities.
Okay, thank you. And I just have one more question, I think, before we open it up to you all. I didn't realize this going into the book, that it was set a few years in the future, giving it sort of like a dystopian flair, I guess. Why did you do that?
Really, well, I was thinking along the same lines as I was in Inventing the Countries. And because the things I'm depicting aren't quite happening exactly in the real world the way they are in the novel, I felt that to get a reader to come with me freely, one, I'd have to make up two countries, and two, it'd be best to be set in the near future. Mm-hmm. And there's something eerie about that. And I had a job once as a canoe guide in a camp in Algonquin Park for little girls. It was a great job, and every 3 or 4 days, I'd take these girls out, sort of 8 to 14, on a canoe trip for a few days. In addition to being their guide, I had to tell ghost stories at night. And I discovered that there's a trick to telling a really good ghost story and scaring the wits out of a girl around a campfire. And the thing you need to do is to make the victim vaguely resemble one of the kids around the campfire. And that really terrifies a kid. You know, and that's, you know, some kids, they want that. That's exactly what they're looking for. Frighten me and make me scared. And so it's a little scary to think that the world that's being depicted is just around the corner in 2018. And I think it can have the same kind of reverberation, same kind of eerie danger when it's quite likely where we are, but it's just a little bit ahead of us. So I think it can add to the kind of the, my goodness, this is where we could go if we weren't careful. If we let our worst instincts dominate our better instincts, this is where we could be heading. So that's why I set it in 2018, to sort of make it more eerie and to give the reader license to suspend disbelief and follow me to an imaginary world. It's real in every sense, except that it's a bit made up.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I'm going to use that campfire trick in the future. With full credit, of course. So we're going to open it up to questions. Just raise your hand, please, if you have one.
Thank you so much for being here and sharing your experience with you. I have a question. It's a bit of an any known blood question, but it may also apply to your latest work. In any known blood, the protagonist skillfully came from such a difficult and challenging place, introspected, and was sort of down and out, but through exploring history, managed to sort of come to grips with things that were part of his own self and his own character, and in the end, resolved things about that. I thought in a way that was so clever and brought the whole book together. I'm wondering, is in writing these novels, is there like a similar kind of introspection for you in terms of these lingering questions that you have, where you, through your characters, you can kind of resolve these things for yourself?
Sure. Are there questions that I'm trying to resolve myself when I'm writing about characters who are struggling? For sure I am. And well, the novel you're talking about, Any Known Blood, my second, and thank you for the question, starts out in a downbeat, in a way I haven't written any other novel. And the character, the protagonist in Any Known Blood, he's a complete wipeout in the original opening pages of the book. He's been divorced by his wife for good reason. He's been fired from his job for good reason. He's been disowned by his father. He's just in a mess, and he's groundless, and he's lost. And I thought, what an interesting way to begin a novel with a character who's completely lost, and it's my job to build him up and give him some dimension. And so he digs into the history of his own family to find himself. And so I guess it's not, and he feels, and he is in a way, he feels that in the opening pages of the novel that he's a total failure in life. And so, and he's got to climb from that bottom to somewhere more fulfilling by the time the story ends, or at least show himself to be on the way up to being functional and leading a rich life again. And it was an interesting challenge logistically. How do you create a character who's very unappealing and weak and failing in every respect in the opening pages, and make that person interesting, and then let that person begin to ascend, you know, to a better place? So it was an interesting challenge. And as for what that reflects about me, well, I think we all worry, most people who are ordinary, about whether we're failing or what, you know, whether we're succeeding or whether we're moving in the directions our life we'd like to take in our lives. And we all worry about how we're doing from time to time. And so it's only natural. So I could worry about that myself as an individual and as a writer. And so it wasn't hard to imagine, you know, a character who was totally down and out, who was failing on every front.
I'm just wondering, what types of books do you read in your free time, and what would be your favorite book, or the book that you would recommend? Not of your own books, but which of a type that's not your... Actually, you can tell me what your favorite book of your own is also, but what type of book would you read on your downtime or on your off time, and what is the read that you would recommend to people that you really enjoyed reading?
Well, there's so many books I've loved. I don't know where to start. I loved All My Puny Sorrows by Miriam Taves. I thought that was a work of utter genius. I loved Bel Canto by Ann Patchett, except for the last three pages. but still, I forgive her because it was a work of genius, Bel Canto. Those are two books I've absolutely loved, Bel Canto by Ann Patchett and All My Puny Sorrows by Miriam Taves. Yeah. But I don't really like to think of having a favorite of my own books. And it's because, we have a lot of challenges as writers, and the last thing you want to be is become your own worst enemy and be always kind of comparing yourself to your previous creations. And the way I try to get to a good headspace where I can think positively about myself, I don't mean arrogantly, but at least positively. And so I just try to imagine my own work being a mural, and each book is some paint that I've thrown at that mural, and there's no reason why I can't respect or feel good about each bit of that mural. And each bit expresses a different heartbeat, a different frame of mind, a different preoccupation or obsession that might encompass a 3 or 5 year section of my life of writing. But I don't have to, and I don't really want to judge my own work as better or worse one than the other, just because I like to kind of like them all. Not that I think they're perfect. I know they're not. Not that I don't feel I can improve. I know I can improve. I know I need to keep growing as an artist. But I'm sure I'm as conscious as any person about the flaws in each of my books. But I still like to like them, even with their flaws, and just let them sit as bits of paint on the mural that's my life's work.
Lawrence, first of all, I want to say thank you for being in Ottawa. It's awesome to see you here, as always. The next thing I want to say is that up until I was 12 years old, I was a Palestinian refugee in Lebanon, so your story does speak to me personally. And I want to say that a lot of people might look at refugees and think that they are just such like miserable souls, but I want to tell you something. Growing up as a refugee kid, I think it gives you that perspective that not a lot of like regular kids have, because you're always looking at you're always finding joy in the smallest things in life, which always gives you more hope that things will always get better. So I think that the refugees that will end up here will actually flourish. They won't end up as a miserable social assistance kind of people. The second thing, I want to ask you a question. I don't want to ruin it for people, but in some instance, with coordination between the government of Freedom State and Zantoraland, some people are sent back to Zantoraland to be persecuted by the regime. They're wanted by the Zantoraland regime. How much does that speak to the coordination between former colonial powers with current dictatorships in Africa and other parts of the world?
Thank you, Waleed. And by the way, I should mention that Waleed talks about, you know, being, I think the term you used was a refugee kid. And Waleed's just graduated with a degree in engineering from the University of Ottawa. So there you go. That's the exact point I was trying to make earlier. What kind of correlation is there between the novel and the politics and the novel in the real world? Well, there are many correlations, and there's a terrible kind of corruption going on in the novel involving both nations, and involving the trafficking of refugees. I don't want to say too much because it's a criminal procedure that becomes clarified as the novel unfolds. So I don't want to give all that away. But I was thinking about the real world, and I believe that Australia has paid other nations to take refugees, and in the countries, some have done their best to avoid taking refugees to get others to take them instead. And so I was thinking of the real world, and there's also a kind of abduction going on in the novel, which you discover early, and the country of Zantoraland, you know, is abducting its citizens and then demanding huge ransoms to be paid is a form of generating cash. And if you don't pay the ransom, it's completely understood that the country will execute that person. So they will execute if they don't get the ransom in the novel. And after finishing the novel and seeing it come out, just a few weeks ago, I read a piece about how this was happening in Syria right now. I read a piece in, I think, The Globe or The New York Times. I've been reading so many papers, I don't remember which articles I've read in which paper, but so it's happening right now in Syria, and I wasn't aware of it when I was writing the novel. And so, yes, I was thinking about real-life situations, but just making them worse and pushing them to a worse place. And the frame of mind I had was, like, if a country wanted to be as brutal as imaginable to refugees, what might it be doing? And indeed, one of the research questions I asked of refugee experts was, you know, what would be the worst policies you've seen around the world, and what could be some of the worst policies imaginable that countries might put in place to oppress refugees? And so I was trying to soak that up to imagine this dystopia. So yes, I was reflecting to some degree what I see happening in the world, but I was also pushing it to an extreme and imagining things getting even worse.
Hi there. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about adapting your book into a television script and about how you felt seeing it make that transition.
Sure. And is there anything about that adaptation you wanted me to talk about?
I guess more how you felt sort of at the end. I mean, it's so different to go from a book to sort of condense it down into, I think you had mentioned it was a six-part series, so the sort of struggles and sort of the rewards that came out of that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, it was, on the whole, a great experience. All my friends worried that I'd have a nightmare, but it was a great experience. And it went so well that I did choose to sell the rights to The Illegal to the same people who developed the miniseries for The Book of Negroes. And so I'll be writing the screenplay for the miniseries for The Illegal as well. And working with the same team that did the Book of Negroes miniseries. I was involved from the ground up. I co-wrote the miniseries. I went to the sets in South Africa and in Nova Scotia and in Hamilton, Ontario. I really sort of talked and negotiated and hectored and, you know, bargained with the director and producer for the whole 5 years about what would be in and out, and that was a fascinating experience. I didn't win every argument, but I got to have plenty of influence, even though it's not contractually guaranteed. When you sign a film deal, the first contractual clause stipulates that you waive your moral rights. In other words, you give up the right to control the artistic direction of the production. That's a necessity. Nobody's going to invest millions of dollars if they think that the original writer of the novel is going to mess up the production. So you have to give up your moral rights. Then I tried to work them back, not legally, but but artistically, by co-writing the thing and by being in every conversation about what the story would encompass and what it wouldn't. So, I mean, it's TV, and you have to sort of come at it with a calm and grounded perspective. So if you're hoping to have another novel, you'll be frustrated, but it's television, so it has its constraints and obligations, and I was realistic about that. And really, I think the biggest challenge was emotional, like, would I be emotionally calm in the face of an adaptation? And I had the best training in the world to deal with that. I'd been a journalist, and when you're a reporter, especially a junior reporter, every night you file your story, and every night 4 or 5 hours after you filed it, it's ripped to shreds and reconstituted, and the headlines sometimes bear no resemblance to the story you wrote. And of course, you don't write the headlines anyway. The headlines are written by desk editors, and so often your story might be combined with Agence France-Presse or with Reuters or Associated Press. You don't even know what's going to appear the next day, maybe under your byline if you get one. And so you have to adjust to the idea that your words are going to be ripped apart regularly, and the world won't end. If your sentences change or if your stories change, there are more important things in the world than the fact that your story got changed. So your words aren't sacrosanct. Life will go on, and you don't die if it happens. And so it's really good training, because you learn to adjust in the newsroom to the fact that you have little control over what's going to appear in the newspaper the next day. And especially in your first years on the job, before you've got it all kind of really mastered. And if you can't survive that, you will have an ulcer in the newsroom and you won't make it. And so you learn to just be cool with the fact that often your stories won't look like the way you wrote them. And often, let's be honest, they'll be better as a result of the work that was done on the desk at night. They might have caught a mistake. They might have added paragraphs from a wire service that makes it a much better story. And you have to sort of be humble in the face of the changing words. And that's great training for a film, because my stuff was changed. Obviously, it had to change to adapt. And I was okay with it. It was, you know, there are more important things in the world than feeling that you own the words and nothing must change. And so that was good training. There were things that I had to discover. I mean, violence works a whole different way on screen than it does in fiction. I mean, the things that happen in the novel could never be shown on screen, or the reader would just be the viewer would be totally assaulted. But on a lighter note, the CBC came to me, and God bless them, because they did a fantastic job supporting that miniseries and gave it phenomenal coverage and gave us great leeway. But they came to me, there's a scene in the novel that it's one of my favorite scenes, violent as it is, and at the outset of a slave revolt on a slave vessel, Fanta, a woman who leads the slave revolt, kills a parrot of a man who's been abusing women, you know, who are captives in the slave vessel, and sexually abusing them, and he's party to all the atrocities that take place on the slave vessel. So when she's armed with a knife and is about to go on a killing rampage, the first thing that she comes to is this guy, the medicine man's parrot, who's been getting food that she should have been getting if the world were right, and so she kills the parrot before she goes on to kill people on the slave vessel. And CBC came to me and said, there will be no parrots killed on national television. Murder? Sure. Rape? No problem. But there will be no parrots killed on national television. And they were serious, you know. I mean, and of course it wouldn't have been a real parrot, but nonetheless, you couldn't show that. And that was absolutely non-negotiable. That scene could not survive the transition. And it's funny, but it says a lot too. There's a lot of things that get lost, but then again, there are a lot of things that we gain. That there was a whole scene that had to be chopped from the novel. But at the last minute that I was sad to see go, but they got to come back in the miniseries, which is a conflict between George Washington and Sir Guy Carleton, the commander of the British forces. And I love the fact that I could go to that scene. I got to rewrite the ending of the story in terms of Solomon Lindow's relationship with Aminata and give him a second chance at redemption, which he didn't get in the novel. So this Jewish slave owner gets a second chance to kind of be absolved of his of the things he's done wrong and to do a second thing that was really good to make up for the terrible things he did to Aminata. And so I got to rewrite that ending in a really satisfying way. So it was a really interesting process. You lose a lot and you also gain, and I guess you don't want to be too obsessed with that, but just try to do something that works in its own right. In a new artistic, you know, genre. So I was quite happy with it and proud to be part of it. And I think the actors were great, and I got to be an extra.
There was a question in the middle here, I think. Yep.
Hi, Lawrence. So throughout the evening, and sort of going on the whole public history, and if there's any historians in the audience. Throughout the evening, you've mentioned many historical events, and you have a clear interest in history. How do you feel history has helped develop you as a writer, and where and how do you learn your history? I'm curious because you have a journalism background.
How has history helped me as a writer, and where do I learn my history? Well, I'm acutely aware that I don't have, you know, training as a historian. I'm ashamed to admit the truth, which is that I never even took a single course in history at university. But that doesn't mean I'm not interested in history. I'm absolutely fascinated by it. When I was in grade 8, I thought that the study of history violated my constitutional rights and constituted cruel and unusual punishment. Really, I hated it. It was taught in such a boring way. I was a recitation of dates and facts and military leaders. I detested history. And after grade 9, it was optional, and I never took another history course because I hated it so much, because I wasn't good at the memorization and there was no life, there was no color. I was among, I'm sure, the millions of Canadians that heard nothing about the internment of Japanese Canadians, heard nothing about slavery in Canada, heard nothing about the stories of our nation that are rich and colorful and important. And so I just thought it was boring. And really it was the process of becoming a writer and a more avid reader that introduced me to my passion for history. And because I don't have any training in it, I tend to work extra hard to make sure that when I am writing something historical, I've really come to understand it well. In the case of, well, each book has its own dictates in terms of research, but it seems that my second home is the Robarts Library at the University of Toronto. I just know every inch of that library and have spent half my life in it, researching every one of my books. I've been to many other libraries and archives around the world too, but since I live in or near Toronto, now Hamilton, I tend to spend my time there when I'm researching mostly. So, I don't know, it depends on the book. Histories, historical overviews of the transatlantic slave trade, and then boring right down to details like what were African American women using in the way of hairstyles in the 1700s in South Carolina. Like, I could find that in some scholarly article. It turns out that the one person in the world who's most knowledgeable as a scholar about African American women's hairstyles in the 1750s is a white guy from Australia, and who's published extensively in this area, and his name is Shane White. And he's a brilliant writer, and he's written a great deal about this, and I had to find out about African American women's hairstyles in the 1750s because it becomes pertinent and in a scene in the novel. And so some of the research was very specific. What kind of herbal medicines were women or midwives or other women using to induce abortions? You know, say if somebody was raped, what other herbal remedies were used by midwives? I mean, the research ended up being very specific, but it started on kind of a macro level. The most helpful research were first-person accounts by men and women, black and white, who'd encountered the transatlantic slave trade either as victims or as perpetrators, white or black, in Africa, on slave vessels, and in the Americas. The first person accounts, and the Book of Negroes itself, the document, the ledger, they became the richest sources of information. But first I had to read the macro histories again and make sure I understood them, and of course a whole bunch of slave narratives, again written by men and women, about their lives, you know, in and out of slavery. So, but each, you know, that's a bit about the Book of Negroes research, which lasted for 5 years, but each book has its own, you know, dictates in terms of research. They don't all make me work the same way.
Well, this is a very trivial question. There's lots of running in the book, and the running scenes are very convincing. So, two questions. How did you do the research for the sort of professional African running scene? And also, if you want to tell us any of your PBs for your 5 or 10 or half marathon or marathons, you could do that too.
Spoken like a true runner. Tell you my PBs. Does anybody in the audience know what that means? No, good. Well, that's good. So my personal best, you don't want to hear because they're too slow. But I ran for, you know, I ran hard for about 45 years. I raced through my high school, junior high school and high school and university years. I ran in track teams in high school and university, and also with a club when I was growing up. And I dreamed of making it to the Olympics, and I knew how I was going to win the 5,000 meter gold medal at the Olympics and what I'd launch my finishing kick to win it. But I didn't have the body to go along with the aspirations, and I just wasn't, I wasn't winning any major races, Canadian or Ontario championships, I wasn't winning. And so if I couldn't win any major races, I sure as hell wasn't going to win the Olympics. And so at 16 or so, I figured out that I'd never make it as a elite Olympian, and it was heartbreaking because I was absolutely obsessed with this from the age of 11. Like another kid might be obsessed with making it to the National Ballet or making it to the NHL, and I was sure that I was going to do it if I just trained a little harder. And I was running twice a day. I'd run at 5 in the morning before school, and then I'd train again at 5 in the afternoon. I just ran with unbelievable intensity, but I didn't have the body to go along with the dreams. And so I figured out, and you know, I've never been a parent to tell my kids, you can do whatever you want if you just try hard enough, because it's a big fat lie. It's just not true. You can't do everything you want if you try hard enough. Not everybody's gonna get the gold medal in the 5,000 meters. One person's gonna win, that's it. What about all the other people who didn't make the Olympics, who didn't win or didn't make the final? Are they losers? Like, well, of course they're not. And but they didn't win, and they surely tried just as hard as a winner. So you can't just get everything you dream of. And it's just a really hard lesson as a kid to find out you're not going to make it to the National Ballet, or you're not going to make it into the NHL, or you're not going to be a gold medalist in the 5,000 meters. So at 16 especially, I packed in my my dreams of glory and kept running, because I loved to run. I kept running for decades, but I just decided to be a writer instead, and I'd probably do better at writing than at running. So I, you know, one dream sort of emerged out of the ashes of another, which I think happens to a lot of people. A lot of people hope for something and it doesn't work, and they redirect, whether it's at 16 or at 26, and boom, they found something. And often, out of what you might think is a failure, is really the birth, offers the birth, the opening, the possibility of something new. And so failing as an athlete offered me the opportunity to fixate at an early age on becoming the best writer I could become. So I do know a lot about running and about the pain of of racing. And whether you're running slowly, as I did, or at an elite level, you know, the pain is similar. And but for the scenes in the book, so I could draw upon, you know, 45 years of running, and I did. But for the scenes that went beyond my level of knowledge, I don't know what it looks like to be in the pack of elite runners at the head of the Boston Marathon, and I never will. So I just interviewed, you know, I'm a former journalist, so I interviewed Canada's fastest marathoner. Indeed, not only did I interview this wonderful guy named Reed Colsett, but I also I asked him to read the first few drafts of the novel, which he did, and he commented on the running sections, and I got to ask him all sorts of questions, like, what kind of trash talk is going on in the lead pack of a marathon? Like, what are these guys saying to each other? It's interesting, you know, first of all, you don't want to waste too much breath, but what are they saying? How's that going? And so he was really helpful to me, and so I just went to people who are elite athletes, elite wheelchair athletes, because there's a wheelchair athlete in this novel, and elite able-bodied athletes too. And they helped me formulate details that I couldn't possibly know about from my own experience.
I have two perspectives. I am a child of Sri Lankan immigrants who arrived at Malton Airport in 1958. And I grew up in Don Mills and then Victoria Village as a first-generation Canadian. And then in 1983, we welcomed a lot of our family as refugees when the troubles happened. So I've seen it from both sides. But being in junior high in the 70s and reading books like John Wyndham's The Chrysalids, George Orwell's 1984, talking about a dystopian world, and I used to sit there and think, what's it going to be like in 1984? All the things he's talking about. What's it going to be like, you know, with the chrysalids, with the fringes, and are there going to be segregation like that? So my question, Lawrence, is when you were writing this book, did you, even though it was a shorter period of time, did you imagine what's Canada going to look like in 2016, 2018, even though it's only a few years? Did that come to you to help guide you when you were writing this book?
Yes, what would Canada look like in 2016 or 2018? Yes, it did guide me, but what I was asking myself was, what do I not want it to look like, and what if the worst happened? What if we embrace the worst parts of ourselves, our own inner xenophobia? What could happen if we let loose of our kind of moral principles and kind of gave reason, shoved reason to the side and embraced a sense of fear or insecurity, xenophobia. So not just what might we look like, but what might we look like if things went terribly wrong? Because that's, of course, what you're doing in a dystopia. So I did ask myself the question, what if things went really bad? Hopefully, in not too didactic a way, the novel is a meditation on what could happen if things went really wrong.
Lawrence Hill, everybody. Miigwech, Lawrence.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Lawrence Hill talking about his book, The Illegal, with author and journalist Wob Geeshik Rice and guests in the audience. The event was recorded at Octopus Books in Ottawa last November. If you like what you heard, you can get a copy of your own of The Illegal by contributing to Rabble.ca's fall funding drive. For a contribution of $15 a month or more, you can have the satisfaction of knowing that you're supporting one of Canada's leading online independent media magazines. Rabble listeners and readers are the kinds of people who know that independent journalism is needed more than ever in this country. Your support makes a world of difference, and we appreciate it. Go to rabble.ca/donate to make your contribution and get your copy of The Illegal. Thanks to Octopus Books for making this interview available to us. Octopus has a great series of fall readings, and we'll be bringing some more of them to you on Needs No Introduction. If you're in Ottawa, it's a good night out, full of interesting ideas, people, and books. You can find out more details about the authors in this fall's roster by going to www.octopusbooks.ca. I'm Victoria Fenner, executive producer of the Rabble Podcast Network. Needs No Introduction, Fresh Ideas from Speakers of Note is a production of Rabble.ca. Thanks for listening.